From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and let's get more reaction to last night's debate, which comes just 2 days before the Nevada caucuses. There were six Democratic candidates on stage last night, but the newest one, Michael Bloomberg, is not on the ballot in Nevada. He's got his eyes on Super Tuesday, which is coming up in 12 days. And he took fire from all the other candidates, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, and Pete Buttigieg. Let's bring in NPR's Asma Khalid in Las Vegas. Hi, Asma.
Hey there.
So let's start with former Mayor Bloomberg. It was his first time on the national debate stage, and many are saying he seemed unprepared for some of the pointed attacks he faced, including his support of stop and frisk policies during his tenure as mayor. Here he is.
I've apologized. I've asked for forgiveness. But the bottom line is that we stop too many people. And we've got to make sure that we do something about criminal justice in this country. There is no great answer to a lot of these problems. And if we took off everybody that was wrong on this, off this panel, everybody that was wrong on criminal justice at some time in their careers, there'd be nobody else up here.
Even his own campaign staff have admitted he didn't do as well as expected. What are people saying today?
So he's actually having a rally in Salt Lake City in Utah today. That's going to be voting later in the calendar. As you mentioned, he's not on the ballot here in Nevada. And my colleague Aisha Roscoe has been with him. And she says that he has tried to pivot towards a general election message, essentially saying that Donald Trump sees his poll numbers and he's scared. And he also warned against nominating Bernie Sanders, saying it would be a fatal error. But to the point of sort of cleanup of yesterday's debate, I mean, look, the campaign has been suggesting that a lot of folks came out directly to target Mike Bloomberg and that he had not been on the debate stage. He hasn't debated in over a decade. I think that's a sort of tricky question. I mean, he has the money and the ad space to be able to change the narrative, regardless of what people saw in last night's debate. But like you said, he's not actually on the ballot. He's not going to be a contested force until Super Tuesday. So I don't know that we have a clear sense of how this actually shakes out with voters yet.
Well, and it was surprising, given that Bernie Sanders is in the lead in basically all the polls at this point, how few attacks compared to Bloomberg that he got. He stood his ground on several of them, though, including criticism of his Medicare for All plan. But on how to pay for it, let's listen to the answer. Here he is in an exchange with Pete Buttigieg.
When saving people money because they don't pay any premiums, out-of-pocket expenses, co-payments, or deductibles. They're going to be much better off.
But where's the other $25 trillion supposed to come from? At a certain point, you got to do the math.
Well, we got it all up there on internet. It's a payroll tax. A payroll tax.
No, but even after the payroll tax.
So does Bernie Sanders need to be able to provide more concrete details about how he's going to fund and get support for some of these policies that he's been talking about?
So, Jeremy, he has been asked about that many times, specifically around how he's going to fund Medicare for All. And thus far, I will say, despite the fact that he's been asked those questions from some of his opponents and the fact that he's been asked some of those questions from some of his own Democratic opponents, it does not seem to sort of hamper any of his momentum. He is seen to be, and I would argue, sort of the clear front runner in the number of recent polls. Here on the ground in Nevada, his staff has a very large operation, I believe over 200 staffers. They've been making a lot of inroads into the Latino community, and that's something that won't just benefit him here in Nevada, but also in some key Super Tuesday states like California and Texas.
Why do you think that more of the candidates didn't go after Bernie last night?
I think that's a really interesting strategic question. I think for a long time there was an assumption that Bernie Sanders sort of had a ceiling of voters. I would argue that that is a somewhat faulty assumption at this point because we have seen that he has been able to grow his base of support. There is a sense that you need to knock down among some of these candidates who are in the more centrist, I should say moderate lane, that they need to knock down one another in order to be able to consolidate that moderate path. And in part, that's because they're looking at all of the support that someone like Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar, and Pete Buttigieg collectively got in a state like New Hampshire. And they'll say, well, it was more than what Bernie Sanders got. What I will say is that this is a very similar argument to what I heard from Republicans in 2016 as Donald Trump kept picking up state after state.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say that after Super Tuesday, or even before, it comes down to Bernie Sanders and his support and somebody else that has to go up against Bernie Sanders. Who came out of last night's debate best positioned to be that somebody else?
I don't know that we have a clear answer for that. If you're looking at the debate just in isolation, it was a very strong night for Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. She had the strongest, the harshest critique lines against Mayor Bloomberg, and it was clear to folks on the, you know, sort of paying attention to her, who have followed her for a long time, that, you know, this is a woman who has been a fighter, who has a clear prosecutorial sort of track record of taking on folks and questioning them in the banking world. But with Elizabeth Warren, you know, she didn't have the strongest performances in Iowa and New Hampshire. And so I don't know that we have a very clear sense of who is the natural front runner. I think people thought maybe that opponent to Bernie Sanders could be Mike Bloomberg, but his debate performance last night looked rocky.
Yeah, if the argument right now is about who can win, Elizabeth Warren's fourth place finish in neighboring New Hampshire from her home state of Massachusetts, it doesn't look good for that. But we'll see if last night's debate changes much. Asma Khalid of NPR, thank you.
You're welcome.
To Germany now, where authorities are investigating a mass shooting that they believe could be connected to extremist far-right beliefs. They say the suspected shooter, a 43-year-old man, shot and killed 9 people at several locations in suburban Frankfurt overnight. Authorities believe the victims all come from migrant backgrounds. Joining us now is NPR Central Europe correspondent Rob Schmitz. He's in Berlin. And Rob, what more do we know about what happened in these attacks?
Well, last night at around 10 o'clock local time, a gunman opened fire at a hookah bar and then at another one in the city of Hanau outside Frankfurt, and he killed 9 people and injured 6 others. One of them is critically injured. Clientele at both bars are predominantly Turkish and Kurdish Germans, though at this hour police are not releasing their identities. After the shootings, the suspect then returned to his apartment, and that's where police found his body and the body of his 72-year-old mother with a gun beside them. Police believe the suspect is a 43-year-old German citizen who is a resident of Hanau. Authorities in the German state of Hesse say they're investigating the crime as a probable right-wing extremist terrorist attack.
Do we know any more about his ties to potential right-wing groups?
We don't. The authorities, the federal prosecutor of Germany had a very brief press conference this afternoon, and they stated that they had found a written confession at the suspect's home in which he wrote that certain races need to be eliminated. They also say he left a rambling video monologue filled with conspiracy theories that indicate he was a racist and had right-wing extremist views.
What strikes us is that mass shootings are not very common in Europe, but especially over the last five years or so, we've seen this growth in the far right. Can you talk more about the threat that the far right poses there?
Yeah, you know, obviously Germany is a country that has spent decades working to reconcile its past, but this right-wing extremism in this country has been on the rise since around 2015, when Chancellor Angela Merkel made a difficult decision to allow hundreds of thousands of migrants from war-torn countries in the Middle East and North Africa to find refuge here. After that, there were several terrorist attacks by Islamic extremists in Europe and in Germany, followed by terror attacks by right-wing extremists in Germany. According to government data, the number of right-wing extremists in Germany now has risen by a third from last year alone. German intelligence now suspects there are more than 32,000 extremists, and half of them are considered potentially violent with a high affinity for firearms. And this attack comes, you know, after another shooting in Berlin a few days ago at a Turkish comedy show that killed one person, and it comes 4 months after a right-wing extremist shot and killed 2 people while trying to attack a synagogue in the city of Halle.
Has Angela Merkel responded at all to this or said anything about this?
She made a brief statement around noon today here in Germany in which she basically just said that racism is poison and that these extremist views that the shooter harbored are poisonous to German society, and that her government was trying to unite Germany and will strive to do that in the future.
We're reading that the suspected shooter possibly had a firearms license. Can you tell us more about his guns?
Well, in this attack, police found his gun, which was a Glock 17 semi-automatic pistol. which is a gun that here in Germany, with the right license, that one can buy online. But, you know, actually gun laws in Germany, of course, compared to the U.S., are very stringent, and they've actually been tightened further in recent years after other mass shootings. You know, going further than that and looking at extremism itself, you know, Germany's government is in the midst of planning an overhaul of its domestic intelligence and law enforcement agencies this year in an effort to crack down on this type of extremism. The Bundestag, which is Germany's parliament, has approved 600 new jobs to help tackle this rising problem.
That's NPR Central Europe correspondent Rob Schmitz. Rob, thank you.
Thanks, Tanya.
Most of us spend our lives living out a daily routine. We get up, go to work, maybe exercise, spend time with loved ones. These are all activities we take for granted until something like a cancer diagnosis turns the mundane into something precious. The new film Ordinary Love takes on this idea, introducing us to Tom and Joan, a long-married couple played by Liam Neeson and Leslie Manville. Their charming and non-eventful lives are turned upside down when Joan finds a lump in her breast that turns out to be cancerous. Tom immediately pledges his support.
There isn't a moment I won't be there with you.
I know.
I'm going to torture you. You know that, don't you?
Torture me now.
Good. You know what to expect, man.
I'm frightened.
I know, kid. I know. Every moment.
This diagnosis will test their relationship, despite the deep love the two have for each other. Again, the film is Ordinary Love and stars Liam Neeson and Leslie Manville, both of whom join us from NPR studios in New York. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hello.
Hi, Tanya.
I want to play a little bit of a scene. This is before Joan gets her diagnosis and she's worrying about what's going to happen.
If you have breast cancer, which I don't think you do, if you have breast cancer, we will do whatever has to be done. The two of us, that's what's going to happen.
You know, this is just one of the scenes that really shows how this relationship between these two characters feels so familiar. I mean, we really feel as if we're watching two people who've been together for years. I'm really curious, how do you go about creating that kind of intimacy?
Well, you can't be too prescriptive about it. I mean, the relationship was very well written on the page, and the rest you kind of have to leave up to, you know, instincts and how you all come together on the day. I think Liam and I work quite similarly in that we do the homework we need to do. We learn the lines and we come in and we know the shape of things. But then you just start playing it and you play off the other person. You know, I was very much playing off what Liam was giving me and vice versa. We were very relaxed with each other, very easy.
Joked a lot.
We what?
Yes.
We choked.
Joked.
We joked.
I thought you said
lot.
Choked. No, joke. We did joke. we did choke a lot. So it was light. You know, the atmosphere was light, despite the fact that we're doing a scene, a film with heavy drama in many ways, although it's also quite funny and very beautiful and a touching love story about two people that you don't often see love stories told about. You know, a very ordinary couple and still liking each other and...
making each other laugh.
Yeah.
The script was based on the writer, Owen McCafferty, who is mainly known as a theatre writer and a wonderful one too. This is his first screenplay, and it was based on an episode in his life with his wife, lovely
That's
wife,
right.
Peggy. And this is the type of banter he comes up with.
Yeah. We all know you for your action movies, for instance, Taken. But this is really a departure from that tough guy who has it all under control. Is that what drew you to Tom?
Yes, I guess. I mean, I'm still making action movies, believe it or not, at the age of 67. Sorry for laughing. Oh, God, that's so sad.
No, it's not. People love it. Is. You know you've got the number one GIF out there from Taken,
oh, the
where
GIF.
You're holding the phone and you say, I will find you and I will kill you.
Yeah, I know. God, if I had a penny for every time someone said that to me, I'd be very rich. But
oh,
still,
I'm
no.
Sure.
It was great to do, you know, especially at that juncture in my life. I was 54. No, I just turned 55 when the first one, when we completed the first Taken. And it's nice to have a departure. It's not to show off or anything like that. I just, the older I get, the more I love writers. And it's my passion is to read. But to read a script starting at page one and finish at page 92 or something and think, I haven't stopped for a cup of tea. I didn't go to the bathroom once. There's just something, a quality about this script that's true and real and deeply touching. And and that's what Ordinary Love did for the pair of us.
Mm. Yeah. You know, you're playing someone who's basically helpless. I mean, Tom has to watch Joan go through this surgery and then chemotherapy. And she's suffering and there's so little you can do to help her. I'm just curious, what was that feeling like to explore?
Well, I've had four relations in my immediate family and my wife's family who died of breast cancer. Mm. I know when these deaths happened, how it affected me, and it was very easy to kind of channel that, certainly in scenes with Leslie and the possibility that she may not survive this.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm a man, I've lived a life, Leslie has lived a life for her age, and we just allowed that to come out of ourselves without really deeply scratching the surface. Do you know what I mean?
Yep, I know exactly what you mean. Leslie, a lot of times when actors play people with disease, they do research so that they can portray it really more accurately. But I actually read that that was something you did not want to do. Why?
Well, because when you're going through what Joan is, it's all happening new to them. You know, Joan hasn't researched breast cancer. She didn't. And because we had real chemo nurses and biopsy nurses, technicians working with us, I mean, in the scenes, they would talk me through what each piece of machinery would be doing, what the biopsy with the big needle would be like, and et cetera, et cetera. And so I didn't want to really be very, very prepared because it's happening to Joan for the first time.
You know, I know the exact moment when I burst into tears in watching this film. It's when your character, Liam, says out loud, how do you say to someone, don't die? And I think that's a question that all of us kind of have when we are experiencing someone in our lives, either through old age or through health reasons, we are watching them die. But there are also moments of anger here. We see a number of scenes where Joan and Tom lash out at each other. How important was it for you to show this side of Tom, Liam, in the relationship?
I think it was very important because, you know, otherwise you get this reverential scene after scene after scene of care and talking quietly. And it's not human. You know, there's anger and frustration that I can't fix this. The guy's job, generally speaking, is to be a fixer, you know, and he can't fix this. We have a great argument. It's a lovely scene, actually, where I'm asking her, did you take this particular pill? Joan, Leslie's character, saying, it doesn't matter, just pass me a pill. It doesn't matter which one. And I'm saying, it's absolutely important we know which one, which leads to this row where they literally do shout at each other and throw things at each other.
We're both going through this.
No, we're not, Tom, we're not. I'm going through it. You just got to cope with things, cope with stuff. I ain't had the cancer. I ain't going through chemo. I ain't going to have a double mastectomy.
I'm doing my best here.
I ain't not.
I'm glad we had that scene. And it's important because it's real and it's frustrating and it's a way of just releasing some sort of angst and worry and fear, you know.
Yeah, it's vital that you have that in there.
As you mentioned, Liam, earlier, this film was written by Owen McCafferty based on his own experiences with his wife, Peggy. Did that put more of a responsibility for you guys to get it right?
Yes, for that reason and for all the millions of women who go through it. You wouldn't want to sugarcoat this subject or sentimentalize it and not present it accurately, because there'd be a lot of justified outrage. But I've spoken to lots of women who've seen the film in England and in Canada when I was at the Toronto Film Festival with it, who've been through the same thing. And there was a sense of relief from all of them that a film was compassionately but accurately showing what they'd been through without it being just doom and gloom.
Yeah.
You know, with it being about carrying on having a sexual relationship, carrying on going to the supermarket, getting on with their lives, you know, that that life with all its multi facets carries on even though you've lost your hair and you're about to lose your breasts, and you know, it's
yeah, and you still have to go to the supermarket and buy groceries to eat for that week, you know.
Yep.
All that minutiae of life is incredibly important to show, and I thought Owen wrote that very, very bravely.
What would you say to people who will hear that Ordinary Love is about a couple dealing with breast cancer and say, I'm not sure if I want to see a film about cancer? Maybe there's fears about it being too depressing or something that they've had to face in their own lives.
Tanya, I would say the film is a love story. That's what it is. It's a love story. It's got hope. It's got potential. It's got vibrancy. It's got a lust for life. And breast cancer, yes, is the basis of I guess, what the story is based on. But it's a film of love and hope.
Leslie Manville and Liam Neeson star in the new film Ordinary Love. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you.
We're just days away from the caucuses in Nevada and less than 2 weeks away from Super Tuesday. And we are checking in with some Super Tuesday states today, looking at Colorado. We're joined by Megan Verlee, public affairs editor at Colorado Public Radio. She's in Denver. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Jeremy.
So there hasn't been a single poll in the state of Colorado since last August. Bloomberg wasn't even a candidate then, and many other candidates have since dropped out of the race. What do we know about the state of the race in Colorado?
Well, I mean, all we really have to go by are the appearances the candidates make, the kind of crowds they're drawing. We had Bernie Sanders here over the weekend. He probably brought in the biggest Democratic primary crowd we've seen so far, but a lot of interest when Buttigieg came to the state. Warren's coming this weekend. We'll see what kind of crowd she draws. So in terms of enthusiasm, the state voted very, very blue in 2018. It seems like there's a pretty strong Democratic desire to vote against the president and his party, but which Democratic candidate they want to pick is pretty much a black box right now.
Well, let's talk about Bernie Sanders, who's leading in the national polls. And as you said, he was in Colorado. Here he is speaking in Denver on Sunday.
Well, I don't tell anybody, but I think we're going to win here in Colorado.
Megan, what kind of ground games do any of the candidates have there in the state? Do they have staff that are working full time in Colorado?
Most of the campaigns do at this point. Sanders, of course, benefits from having the organization that helped him win in 2016. I think one thing that I'm very curious about is the Bloomberg ground game. Because he's been funding gun control groups for so long, and that is a very strong movement in the state after the many mass shootings here, I think he might have more on-the-ground popularity than is necessarily reflected by his late entrance into the race if the folks who care passionately about that issue really connect him with it.
Now, President Trump is in Colorado today. He's going to be with Senator Cory Gardner, who's considered one of the most vulnerable Republicans seeking re-election this year. Does it help Gardner to have Trump's support in a state that Trump lost?
I think it absolutely does. Gardner needs Republicans to vote for him. And if he is seen as having any distance from this president, he's going to lose the base voters that are absolutely necessary to even have a chance of competing in November. It does put him at risk with swing voters in the state, but I think he's counting on the idea that the president might have enough popularity here with the economy being so good and with his track record over the past few years that I think Gardner's hoping to just get an overwhelming Republican turnout.
Colorado switched from caucuses to a primary for the presidential contest this year. Do you think that's going to have an impact on the outcome on Super Tuesday?
Absolutely. We'll just have a lot more people participating. It's also a semi-open primary. That means if you're an unaffiliated voter, you get both the Democratic and the Republican ballot and you only return one. The plurality of voters in Colorado are unaffiliated. And so one thing we're going to be watching for and curious about is you might have Republican voters who, because they know who's going to win their side if they're unaffiliated, sort of Republican-aligned voters who, as unaffiliateds, can vote in the Democratic primary and either maybe try and spoil it, or if they're not too happy with the president, try and pick a moderate that they could live with. Similarly, we have a lot of probably Democratic-leaning unaffiliated voters, and it will be very interesting to see who they choose now that they can participate in this process.
That is Colorado Public Radio's Megan Verlee in Denver. Megan, thank you.
Thank you.
Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced today he's opening a six-month investigation into the country's unprecedented fire season to better prepare for the future. The fires were fueled by years of drought, went on for months, and killed at least 33 people and more than a billion animals. The fires are now under control, but the recovery effort is just beginning. Australia's Environment Minister recently convened a panel to see which wildlife need the most urgent attention after the fires. And they came up with a list that includes 113 species. Joining us now from Australia is someone who serves on the Wildlife and Threatened Species Bushfire Recovery Expert Panel, Dale Nimmo, an associate professor in wildlife ecology at Charles Sturt University in New South Wales. Dale, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what kind of species are you and your colleagues on the panel most concerned about?
There's a range of species that we're pretty concerned about because of the extent of the fires. So the fires burnt 8 million hectares, which is equivalent to the size of Kentucky or Virginia, about that size, or Iceland, if you like a different comparison. And so because of the extent of the fires, there's been a number of species caught in the path of the fires. And we've just gone through and thought about the ones that are most likely to be negatively impacted by the fires based on both the amount of their habitat that's burnt and their status prior to the fires. So Australia has a lot of threatened species, so species that were at risk of extinction prior to the fires, and then fires have gone over the top of their habitat and probably imperiled them further. And then we also thought a little bit about the species' responses to fire, because Australia is a fire-prone landscape. So some species have adaptations that will allow them to bounce back quickly, and some species might even benefit from a fire. Whereas other species will be negatively affected. They might be reliant on those types of habitat features that are burnt during fires. So it was all those types of things we considered.
So which species are at the top of your list in terms of being in the most trouble right now?
On top of the list, species like the western ground parrot. So this is actually a species over in southwestern Australia. A lot of the attention went to kind of the eastern Australian fires, but there's also been pretty large fires in western Australia. And this was a species that was critically endangered prior to the fires, and there was only about 150 individuals left. So when you've got such a small population, that's when a large fire can really, you know, potentially cause extinction. And so that's one of the species that we're particularly concerned about. When we think about the mammals, there's species like the Kangaroo Island Dunnart. And so this is a species that lives on a large island off South Australia that had a really large, intense fire. And the species is only known from that island. So Dunnarts are they're in the same family as Tasmanian devils and quolls, but much smaller.
They look like little mice almost, right?
Yeah, they're little. They used to be called marsupial mice. We call them Dunnarts now, or Antechinus. There's a number of different small Dasyurids. But this one only occurs on that island. So it's a narrow range endemic species. And so when you have a big fire rip through the majority of the island, then of course you're going to be concerned about whether it's there. The good news is for that species, there was really concern that it might be completely gone, but we have seen some footage of them. They put some camera traps out and found them, and now I'm led to believe that they've actually rapidly installed a massive predator-proof fence to ensure that feral cats and foxes can't get in and knock the last individuals off. So that's really good kind of rapid intervention that might actually prevent that species from going extinct. There's another species that we're concerned about is the long-footed potoroo. So this is an animal that's a bit like a miniature kangaroo, and it was endangered prior to the fires. So we were already concerned about its conservation because habitat loss, mainly for agriculture, has led to, you know, land clearing, basically. So the forests that it lives in have been cleared. And on top of that, these feral predators that we have, mainly feral cats and foxes, really hammer these animals because the size range they're in is just perfect for these invasive predators. So then these fires have swept through a really large proportion of their forest habitat. And so that's another species that's on our radar.
What about the iconic species of Australia like wallabies and koalas?
We are concerned about koalas and they are on the list. Yeah, wallabies, there's rock wallabies on the list. Yeah, so there are species in New South Wales, Queensland and Victoria that occur on rocky outcrops. But yeah, I mean, the long-footed potoroo is probably the kind of macropod or the wallaby-like creature that we're most concerned about.
How concerned are you about the impact the fires had on plants?
We're very concerned, but the task of actually prioritising them is just so much greater than it is for animals because there's so many more species. So at the moment we've released a list of 113 animals, and that's not the full list of animals because it doesn't include a lot of the invertebrates that we're concerned about. But the plants are just so diverse and their responses are so much more complex. And so we've got a group that's going through and trying to prioritise that now, but there'll be a lot of plants where their entire range, all the areas that we know of them from, will have burnt. So that process is ongoing and it will probably take a few more weeks.
You know, when we see images of some of the animals who've been in trouble in Australia because of these fires, it's heartbreaking to look at an animal that, you know, is in the middle of just an absolutely destroyed ecosystem. It must be very emotionally difficult to have to go in and try to see what you can do to help these animals, at least the ones that survived.
Yeah, so part of the panel's objectives is to try to minimise animal suffering as well, so particularly of the native wildlife directly impacted by the fires. So, yeah, it is heartbreaking to see those images, but there is a huge kind of workforce, mainly volunteers, out there caring for injured wildlife, particularly the large, more charismatic species tend to get a lot of the attention, koalas and things like that. But I guess one of the positive things about the fires is seeing that collective effort that people come together really quickly and in a surprisingly strategic way, given how unanticipated these fires were, that such a kind of workforce can come together and start caring for our wildlife. And there will be an ongoing process for rehabilitating many of these species and hopefully eventually releasing some of them back to the wild.
As you work to try to fix the problems that these fires created, are you worried that just because of climate change, this could just be the beginning of a new reality in Australia and it could be very difficult for these animals ever to have a comfortable life there?
Yes, and also for people to have a comfortable life here as well. So, you know, we are concerned about these fires being representative of what might be to come because their scale and intensity has been unprecedented. So just the sheer amount of habitat that's burnt over time and the duration of this fire season starting really early. And, you know, a lot of the fires that were particularly alarming had happened before the official fire season in our minds had really even started. Mm-hmm. So there's this increase in the duration of the fire season, the size of the fires, and it's all related obviously to the really dry conditions that we had leading up to the fires. And so, yeah, we are concerned that the efforts that we're putting in now could be undone if we don't make concrete action on climate change a priority.
What gives you hope as you do this work?
Okay, so one of the hopeful things is that the federal government has convened this panel and put up $50 million towards intervening rapidly to prevent extinctions. And so it is unprecedented in Australia for this type of funding to be available in the aftermath of a fire to fund actions that will have a tangible impact on whether species are here you know, in 10 years' time or not. The types of activities that we'll be funding, things like the control of feral predators or herbivores or salvaging species to get them into captive breeding programs, protecting unburnt areas, those types of activities could prevent a species from actually going extinct. And so in that sense, I've been really overwhelmed by the response and the strategic approach that the federal government and the state governments are taking, and the seriousness of it is, it gives me a sense that Australians do value their wildlife enough to step up and intervene when things get dire.
That is Dale Nimmo, who is an associate professor in wildlife ecology at Charles Sturt University in Australia. Dale Nimmo, thank you so much and good luck.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
And you can see photos of some of these animals, the western ground parrot and the kangaroo island dunnart, at hereandnow.org.
This week, European Union leaders voiced concern that some countries in the region have become too dependent on digital services provided by companies based in other parts of the world. To combat this, the EU outlined on Wednesday a proposal that attempts to restore what officials are calling technological sovereignty. Bojan Wiewiórowski is the European Data Protection Supervisor, and he joins us from Brussels. Welcome to Here and Now.
Greetings from the European Parliament in Brussels.
Boichi, first of all, can you explain these steps the European Union outlined yesterday? What is the EU trying to do exactly?
The Commission, which is the executive body of the European Union, has revealed its plan, its strategy on digital steps they are going to take during the 5 years mandate, which started last year and which is going to be held until 2024. So we may say that the main goal of the European Union is not to stay behind those who are developing, and at the same time to create the digital agenda of the actions, which on one hand will lead to the innovations and to development of the services. On the other hand, will keep up the values that the European Union is built on.
So what I'm hearing from you really is that these outline proposals are really meant to bolster the digital economy and keep the EU from being overly reliant on foreign companies. Is that correct?
I would rather say to stay in the normal competition and to stay in the normal development. So this is not getting rid of foreigners, but to stay in the main line of the development of the digital services. But as I said, at the same time, observe those values of democracy that we are very keen on.
How will this work exactly, and how are you going to enforce it? Will tech companies be fined?
That's the strategy, which of course have to be then translated into the actions to be taken. These actions may include some legislative changes, although there is quite a common agreement that the main frame of the legislation in the European Union is already done, and probably for some of the topics we need some improvements, but not necessarily rebuild the whole legislation. But of course, that also means that we want to enforce this legislation that we have, but also trying to stop these activities that Europe recognizes as breaking the values of democracy.
In many ways, this proposal kind of goes against the very model of some of these tech companies. They have users all around the world, and they're constantly sending data across borders. I'm just wondering, is it even technically possible to change that business model at this point, or should he have tried this proposal 20 years ago?
The business model is changing every day, and it will be developing. Building on what is said by American industry, can say that some of the changes that we have introduced in the last years, like, for example, the new privacy law, has been recognized by the big players on the market as something that should be offered also to those clients which are outside of Europe. So that's, for example, why Microsoft has proposed that the implementation of the European rules on privacy protection, which are the most important for my institution will be used also for the customers worldwide.
Boichi, I want to go back to something that you keep saying, and that's the values of democracy and maintaining the values of democracy. How are the way that some of these tech companies operating against what you're calling values for the EU?
We had numerous situations in which the use of the data, especially the personal data, has gone to the extent that is far from the democracy rules. And I think that the scandal of the Cambridge Analytica was a very good example of that. So we, first of all, would like to be leading by example with the, with these rules and values, and also trying to keep them inside these values, which are the fundamental rights of the European Union.
Boichi, critics of this idea of data localization also point out that it's also been used as a tool of censorship, especially in Russia and China. I'm just wondering what you would say to people who worry that the EU is opening up the door to censorship.
I don't believe that there is anything about data localization, which is in the strategy of the European Union. But when we talk about European sovereignty in this field, that means that we may have the preference to the companies and the entities who are preserving the European values, but definitely not the geolocalization in the sense that we have in Russia and in China.
I see. The European Commission also adopted a white paper on artificial intelligence just yesterday. In a press release, the European Commission said it wants to maximize the benefits and address the challenges of AI. What concerns do you have about AI, and how would you suggest the EU regulate that technology?
Well, I'm just talking with you in the break of actually the hearing in one of the committees of the European Parliament about the very practical use of artificial intelligence tools and the information system which are based on that in the field of criminal justice, both on the side of judging, but also on the side of collecting the and interpreting the evidences.
That's Wojciech Wieworowski, the European Data Protection Supervisor in Brussels. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And once again, greetings from quite cold Brussels.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.